couple of weeks ago, I went to the to my eye doctor, ophthalmologist, I guess, and he recommended that I get a new pair of glasses. So I went to the store and sat down with the optometrist, and he fitted me for some new lenses. Changing lenses is kind of a, could be kind of a metaphor for what's happening in the book of Romans that we've been studying. Paul is inviting us into God's big story of the reconciliation of the world, God's plan to reconcile all things, creation, people, communities. But sometimes the stories we get from our world are smaller stories and stories at conflict with God's stories. And so that's been happening in the book of Romans as we've been reading so far. We started at the back of the book, and you heard about the communities having their tensions in Rome, the Christian communities. Now we're going back to chapter 1, where Paul begins to lay some solid theological foundation. Paul invites us, in a sense, to change our lenses and to see what God is really up to in our lives. Let's pray. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our rock and our redeemer. I want to take just a quick stroll through those three last verses that Zach read. Verses 16 to 18. So Mark, you could bring up verse 16 first of all. Paul begins, "For I am not ashamed of the good news or the gospel." Why would Paul say right at the beginning of his letter, "I'm not ashamed of the good news"? Or not ashamed of the gospel. Why might he be ashamed? As I thought about this, I thought of myself, and probably some of you feel the same way. Some days it feels like we are ashamed to be Christians. The fact is that the Christian church over the years has done some things that are pretty shameful. You don't have to look far for examples. You can look into church history, and it's pretty woeful record of anti-Semitism. You can look at some of the countries, even in North America, some of the conflicts between Christians and Muslims, as an example. Those conflicts don't bring any glory to the church. And there are other kinds of things that sometimes makes one ashamed to be thought of as a Christian. A couple of months ago, a Christian musician was charged with multiple sexual improprieties. Songs he has written are in our songbooks, and some of those songs were going to be in our new hymn book, but they have now been removed. And so when we get Voices United, his songs will no longer be sung. Those are things that make us ashamed, maybe embarrassed. So sometimes the church has failed to live up the gospel, and that is a kind of shame, but it's not quite the same thing as being ashamed of the gospel itself. Paul says, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel." He too might have been embarrassed at some of the things Christian communities were doing in the name of the gospel. So why would he begin this day? The church is young, it's very small, it's about 200 people maybe in a city of 1 million people in the capital of the empire. Well, let me suggest quickly a couple of reasons why he might make this statement. The first one could mean, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel," but he's implying, "I'm proud of the gospel. I fly the gospel flag with pride." Paul had dedicated the best years of his life, 30 to 35 years, in service to this gospel. Tramping up and down the Roman Empire, some scholars estimate he walked more than 10,000 miles over that 30 years. Sometimes he took a boat. No trains, planes, or automobiles were available. He had donated his, or he had used his intellect, his time, all of the best that he had to offer in service of this. So when Paul says, "I'm not ashamed," he's saying, in one sense, "No, I'm proud of this gospel. I'm proud to be what he says, I'm a slave of Jesus Christ," in verse 1. So that's one reason. Secondly, he might have been saying, "I'm not ashamed of this gospel, but I know some of you think this gospel has no snob appeal. That is, The gospel arose in this backwater at the edges of empire in Galilee. It appealed to people who didn't have the right education and so on. Even some of the Roman writers in the first century wrote with disdain about this Christian movement. It appealed mainly to women and to slaves, and so they dismissed it. Paul said, I'm not ashamed of this gospel, and not ashamed of the kind of people it draws into its orbit. A third possible reason was it was just plain dangerous to talk about this gospel in the first century in the Roman Empire. Paul says, I'm not ashamed, but maybe I should keep it quiet, out of the radar of the police and everyone else. You see, Paul's message of the gospel was a direct attack on the power and prestige of the Roman Empire. The very first Christian creed was, Jesus Christ is Lord. I don't know if you and I can appreciate how subversive this little confession, Jesus Christ is Lord, was, but in the first century, that could almost be seen as treasonous. You see, Christianity in the first century was definitely not the winning team. We live in a country in which we have freedom of religion and freedom of speech and so on. We haven't been in the situation where we're subject to a world-dominating empire, although we live pretty close to one, one who wants to be dominating. So we have to try and imagine Rome. Rome, home to the Colosseum, the palaces, the roads, the legions always on the march somewhere, the chariots and horses of the mightiest military known. All of this stretching across three continents. The gospel to the Romans was the announcement that a new emperor has taken the throne. That was the word they used, the gospel. The gospel was also the visit, when an emperor went to visit a community, they said, this is gospel good news, the emperor is coming to see us. And when an heir was born to the emperor, that was trumpeted as gospel good news. So, when Paul says Jesus Christ is Lord, I'm not ashamed of this gospel, it can be seen as a direct affront to Caesar and all of his power. Maybe a more modern example will just give you a sense of how this little movement was braced up against this massive, massive empire. Do you remember years ago, almost 30 now, when the Chinese demonstrators demonstrated in Tiananmen Square? And who will ever forget that one night when a young man faced down those tanks in massive Tiananmen Square? One man against all the tanks, all the might of the army. Well, think of the Christian church in Rome that way. One little group of Christians in the midst of this empire. Another reason why Paul might say, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. The gospel message seemed like foolishness to the Jews, seemed like shame to the Jews and foolishness to the Greeks, as Paul says elsewhere. You see, Jesus, the center of this faith, had been crucified, the most shameful kind of death known to both Romans and to Jews. It was designed to be especially degrading. But Paul says proudly in another letter, we preach Christ crucified. To the Jews, a stumbling block, to the Greeks or Gentiles or Romans, whoever, foolishness. So, why would you worship a crucified man? But Paul simply connects the word shame and foolishness with the word gospel. He was not ashamed of this Jesus. And then one more reason. We in the 21st century live relatively affluent, lives of relative affluence. We're fairly comfortable. But perhaps we can't say quite as confidently with Paul, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. And what might be the reasons for that? Well, maybe it's difficult for us to admit that we need salvation. We like to say, well, I need a little touch-up perhaps, a little self-improvement. But we're mostly successful, good people. We don't really need a makeover, do we? But will that do? Is that the gospel's truth? If you listen to the news, the headlines from the past week or month, you know that humans are flawed, and that includes you and me. Martin Luther's definition of sin was being curved in on oneself. That is, I make myself sort of the center of life in the universe, and I forget about God and I forget about my neighbor, the two greatest love commandments. But Paul says, this gospel is good news. I'm not ashamed to proclaim it. So now let's flip it and say, why might it be good news for us? Well, let's continue on in that verse. Verse 16. Not ashamed, but there's several reasons. The first reason is, it is the power of God saving all. The power of God. Paul insists that in Jesus, the power of God has been unleashed in the world. And in fact, if you read chapter 1 and then read to the end of chapter 15, power language brackets this letter of Paul's. The gospel isn't just something, a bromide to make you feel better one day. The gospel is power. The word is dunamis, from which we get our word dynamite. It's a power unleashed in the world and in our lives. Earlier in this text that where Zach read, Paul references the resurrection. The resurrection has defeated the powers of sin and death. Jesus is the true power at work in the world. The gospel is God's explosive, world-changing power. We know how genuine good news always makes a difference, even in our own lives in smaller ways. Somebody says, we're going to have a baby. That's exciting news, and it makes a difference in the lives of the people who announce it. Or someone says, my surgery was successful. That's good news, and it makes a massive difference in the life of the person who announces that. Good news, Paul says, is that power of God that changes the way we live for the better. This is the good news of salvation. And Paul also says it's the power of God saving all who have faith. The word all, that little word all, is used 71 times in the book of Romans. Just a hint of how inclusive Paul sees this gospel, including all people. It should be a reminder to all of us, not to define salvation and not to define the gospel too exclusively, too narrowly. When he says all, he's talking about Jews and Gentiles. In Paul's day, people divided people up into classes, just like we in our day, we often talk about liberals or conservatives or literalists and more liberal interpretations and so on. We divide people into groups, people groups, or based on how they vote or whatever. In Paul's day, they had ways of dividing the world too. The Jews divided the world into two camps. There were them, the chosen people, and there were the rest, the goyim, the Gentiles. They were outside of God's care. For the Greeks, they defined everybody into two groups of those who are educated, the educated class of Greeks and new Greek philosophy and history, and the rest of the people they called the barbarians. Everybody has a way, it seems, of dividing the world up into different groups. But Paul will have none of it. He says it's good news for all. Next verse. Because here is revealed God's justice, or as most translations say, God's righteousness. But righteousness really means more than we often assume it means. In Scripture, in the New Testament, righteousness harkens back to the Old Testament understanding of righteousness. And there it has two meanings. And this is what Paul picks up. It has the meaning of justice, that God is in the business of setting the world at right. God will bring peace and shalom, and that work has begun in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. So that's God's way of righting wrong. That's justice. But the second thing that righteousness means is that God will be faithful to God's promises. And we heard about that several weeks ago when Claire preached on Romans 9 to 11. The Jewish Christians were wondering, has God abandoned the Jews for the church, for the Gentiles? And Paul insists that God will be faithful to God's covenant promises. So when we use the word righteousness, think of those two things. God's justice, he's going to right the wrongs. And then secondly, God's covenant loyalty, God's faithfulness to His promises. That's important. Righteousness is not just a personal transaction between me and God to ensure that I get to heaven. It certainly includes my decision to follow, but it's much deeper and more profound than the way it is often interpreted. At the time of the Reformation, Martin Luther asked, "How might I find a living God?" Luther was torn with doubts about God's mercy, and he thought God was an angry God going around with a red pencil and clicking off every fault he made. In fact, there's a story of Luther. He went to confession sometimes 3 or 4 times a day, and finally his father confessor said, "Martin, come back when you do something really bad." Because he was so obsessed with his guilt. But that's not really the question that Paul is addressing here. People have taken Luther's thought, and Luther made justification and salvation about this personal relationship with God and getting right with God. Again, not entirely wrong, but it doesn't do full justice to the fullness of what righteousness means. The focus on Paul's argument is not our quest for a gracious and loving God. Instead, Paul's focus is on the radical act that God has already reclaimed us in Jesus. And all we need to do is open ourselves up to it and welcome ourselves as part of this story. See the difference? Salvation doesn't depend on our faith. It depends on the faithfulness of Jesus, the righteous one, who went even to the cross because he trusted in God's faithfulness. And so those who believe in Jesus as the risen Christ imitate that very faithfulness of Jesus. So, here is revealed the justice of God. The one who is righteous will live by faith. And then we come to verse 18, which feels a bit like a downer. And I struggled with whether or not, I have to tell you that in the commentaries, there's a real debate raging, as only commentators can do, professors can do. They wonder whether verse 18 belongs with 16 and 17. Some say yes, others say it doesn't. I guess I come down with the ones who say it does. So before you get too turned off, let me just say a few things. And by the way, here's an advertisement. Next Sunday, we're welcoming Melody into fellowship, and Claire's going to be speaking from Romans chapter 6. And then the week after that, we're coming back to this idea of sin and death and the wrath of God. So if you want the full story in 2 weeks, here's a warning and invitation. If you don't like the topic, I guess you'll find other things to do. But if you want to gain some clarity on this, I invite you to come back. But let me just say about this, God's wrath. We shouldn't think of God as something like a Greek god, you know, like Zeus, who's looking for people who are doing wrong and shoots his thunderbolts down and eliminates people. Rather, God's wrath is God's hostility to evil. And when you read on in chapter 1 to 3 of Romans, you understand this. The wrath of God is God not so much interfering in our lives and punishing us when we do go wrong, and it's true. We all know in our hearts that sometimes we do things that do not reflect love of God and neighbor. But Canadian theologian Brad Jersak puts it this way. He said, "The wrath of God should be understood as divine permission to our own self-destructive behaviors." In other words, the wrath of God is God letting us live out the consequences of sometimes unhealthy decisions. As I said, I'll say more about that in a couple of weeks. Oh, I just also want to say that if God is about the business of restoring the world to health and to shalom, certainly God cannot turn God's back on the structural evil and the big evil that happens sometimes in our world and the forces that work towards death. And so it is right that the love of God, which is the primary definition of what God is up to in the world, also has a component of judgment. Today is the dedication of 2 young children. I'm sure that Jack and Clara won't remember anything I've said this morning. But I hope they will also grow up in ways that they understand the gospel invitation to be a part of their lives. You see, the stories we tell are not neutral activities, because we live in a world made up of all kinds of stories, competing stories. But the gospel good news is the story of God's mercy and God's justice. It's an invitation to switch stories or lay aside those less important stories and open our lives to being changed. That is partly what we are about when we bring children to be dedicated. We're inviting them into a larger story, the story of invitation and grace and joy. I want to read a couple of words from hymn number 620. It's hymn is Child of Blessing, Child of Promise. Just listen to these words as we, in a few moments, transition to the dedication. Child of blessing, child of promise, love's creation, love indeed, fresh from God, refresh our spirits into joy and laughter lead. Child of God, your loving parent, learn to know whose child you are, grow to laugh and sing and worship. Trust and love God more than all. Amen.